This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome back to another episode of Star Wars Untold Stories, where your pals at Entertainment Weekly dig deep into the crevices of the galaxy far, far away. What a weird way to start this episode, but frankly, this is going to be a weird episode because we're talking about an extraordinarily fan service heavy episode of Disney Plus's The Mandalorian before going into a defense question mark of Revenge of the Sith, which I think we can all agree is definitely the best of the prequels, but is it better than other Star Wars movies? Who better to talk about that than my pal EW's James Hibbard, editor at large and our man in the galaxy far, far away. James, how's it going?
Doing well.
Also joining us this week is Chancellor Agard, a person who I know has opinions about the prequels, and I've been very excited to talk to him about that all week.
Very silly ones.
Very silly ones, but also very profound ones. Chance, thanks for joining us. I'm Darren Franich, TV critic for Entertainment Weekly. I should have said that, but I didn't. Guys, let's get into episode 5 of The Mandalorian. The title of it is The Gunslinger. There was indeed some gunslinging. It's interesting. We've been a couple of Tatooine-style planets this season so far, so why not just pull the ripcord and go to Tatooine itself, seemed to be the thinking behind this one. James, we were texting about this episode a little bit, but I want to hear your thoughts on episode 5.
Well, I still feel the wind in my face from all the fan service. So many fans, so much service blowing right at you. But, you know, I'm such a Star Wars fan that actually worked on me. You know, I loved, seeing that wretched hive of scum and villainy again, and the Cantina Bar and Tusken Raiders and Dewbacks and speeder bikes. I mean, yes, at some certain point, like the dialogue, it's like, how many more references can you drop to literally everything we know about Tatooine? But I kind of dug it. I mean, I think there are some flaws in the episode, as I'm sure that you have from your texts. But overall, I liked it better than being on the sort of sad farming planet.
Yes, I think last week we said, last week we were kind of stretching for comparison points for what we thought the episode was like. I said Hercules' Legendary Journey. To me, that was at least like an okay episode of Hercules' The Legendary Journey. This was like, for me, a deeply unsatisfying like sub-quest in an open-world video game. I think I texted you, actually, about 10 minutes into the episode, quote, I think I hate this show.
I wasn't going to out you, but yes, that's exactly what you said.
In fairness, though, that was right after the appearance of the kind of boy band looking new bounty hunter, who immediately became my least favorite character on the show. I will say the episode did take some turns from there. I still generally was not so in favor of it. So Chance, James is kind of in the like camp. I'm in the strong dislike camp. Where do you fall on the spectrum?
I am definitely in the dislike camp.
Join me in the dark side.
As someone who is like, I like Star Wars, I like it enough. I wouldn't call myself a super fan, and I think this show in general has just been like, I still don't get why it exists yet.
Yeah.
And this episode just felt like another episode was like, why? What are we doing here? Like, what's the, like, all the fan service I got, but all at the same time, it's like, I don't, like, being back at Tatooine is just sort of like, okay.
Well, and here's kind of my sort of larger complaint, I think, attached to the Tatooine thing is, okay, so we go back to the Mos Eisley Cantina, and, as I've kind of dug deeper into the movies, I really have come to feel that the Mos Eisley Cantina scene in the first movie might be my favorite scene in any of the movies, period, which is obviously pretty high praise, given that, there are good scenes in a lot of these movies, to say the least. But even, like, it didn't seem that scummy or villainous anymore in Mos Eisley. It actually seemed like a pretty nice place where, you know, the kind of funny lady who runs the local, you know, illegal spaceport area, like, is cool babysitting for a while. I guess that's a little bit of my larger complaint, I think, James.
It's toned down.
Well, it's toned down, and you know, to your point, kind of, James, you know, again, I we've discussed our love of kind of the 90s Star Wars video games, and like, this for me did kind of call up the level in Shadows of the Empire where you're just kind of driving your speeder bike around, and I think jumping over multiple Sarlacc pits, the canon was a little hazy. But I do appreciate that aspect of it, but for me, it was this sort of G-ratedness of it that came to the fore a little bit more. But how did you feel about, because I guess the core of the episode was the kind of like sniper showdown, you know, bounty hunters turning on each other thing. Did that kind of work on you?
Well, I have to go back to the auto mechanic first, or the ship mechanic, because, you know, there was a moment near the beginning where I was worried that the whole episode would be this Amy Sedaris Adventures in Babysitting storyline of her just watching Baby Yoda, that basically Baby Yoda's going to take over the show, just like it's taken over social media. I loved being back in the cantina bar. I think the reason why it wasn't so scum and villainous as before, I mean, you know, it seems like he went there like during hour, you know, but the real reason is because, you know, is because of the budget. You know, they can't afford to stock a whole bar
with
exotic aliens.
This show costs more than
extras.
This show costs more than the original Star Wars movie did at times. You're telling me they couldn't afford extras?
Yeah, but you can't do it the way the original Star Wars movie did, you know, and sort of have it look, you know, remotely contemporary. So, you know, I do wonder if the droid at the bar is the same D9D from Jabba's palace, and he was fired after letting in 3PO and R2D2, and now has to work as a bartender. I also like that Tatooine the bar has progressed as it went from "we don't serve their kind here," talking about droids, to a droid like working at the bar, which brings up my other thing I really liked, and that is the sort of redemption of the reputation of the Tusken Raiders a bit. You know, they've always, you know, because the way they framed it this time is like, oh no, these aren't just like these, you know, horrible creatures. They're actually sort of like the Native Americans of Tatooine, which actually now is that's almost a little bit of a subversive thing to do, because it kind of makes the way they were depicted in the earlier movies seem like kind of horrible.
I got a lot of thoughts on that, but Chance, you had some thoughts that you wanted to share
first.
Well,
I think the thing about the budget, which is sort of interesting, which I thought about this watching when I watched last week's episode, how like, you could tell there's a lot of money in this show, but where they're using it is very odd. Like, all the sets and all the locations look expensive, but feel kind of like hollow. Yeah. And just like, I don't know, like, especially like when he's like in the ship. But even in this episode too, like Tatooine, it's like we're on Tatooine, it still just feels like, I don't know, it feels like he's walking around a set and not like a real, like,
yeah,
place.
It always feels a little underpopulated. But I will say, to give the show some credit, and again, I hated this episode, I did kind of think that, like, you know, there is this weird feeling each week as we get to the kind of, oh, this is a 35-minute episode. That's kind of been the general strike zone so far. And 35 minutes is kind of a weird length of time where, you know, when they got out to where they actually were chasing down their bounty, and you realized, oh, it's kind of like, it's kind of like a Hurt Locker sniper duel now. Like, that's kind of what we're on. Like, I was kind of like, okay, that's a cool episode, actually, like, unto itself, you know, where you kind of imagine it'll be okay, like, the sniper's over here, and they're over here. I actually thought they were going to do the reveal where the Mandalorian was sleeping. I totally thought it was going to be that he got out of his armor and stuck around, and the armor was empty. But of course, he never takes the armor off, so that didn't work out. But then, with the budget they have, it's kind of like, no, we're going to jump right into this super fast, zoomy, you know, we need to distract the sniper action sequence. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's weird, as Chance was saying, to see what they're spending money on and then what they're not necessarily spending money on. Where do we stand on the dude with an earring? Because I have to say, I was ready to totally despise him, but I did kind of like how he ultimately kind of became this example example of like the wannabe bounty hunter who's like so terrible that he just like winds up kind of basically trying to kill everyone, and then, you know, I thought that was kind of a somewhat more interesting arc, certainly, than, as you were saying, James, last week's we're all farmers and we all love each other thing. This was a little, I thought a little sharper in some ways.
Yeah, for most of the episode, he felt like a Disney Channel character from like an after school show, kind of dropped into the Mandalorian completely with his like earring, but he had what might have been my favorite shot in the whole show so far. You know, the twin suns sunrise, a counter to the famous twin suns, you know, sunset in A New Hope, and that profile shot where he suddenly kills Fennec. Is that how you pronounce the character's name? I didn't expect that, and it was also a really cool shot. So
kind of the surprise of the episode, right? Yeah, which like and obviously, I mean, you know, to think about surprises, let's come out a little bit here, because the end of the episode was, I think, kind of the first big maybe mystery of the show so far, beyond the existence of Baby Yoda. We saw a mysterious figure walking through the desert, going to Fennec's corpse, apparently, which I'm guessing is not a corpse, because why would you cast
Probably
her
not.
for a seemingly quite short run role? James, who is that person?
Well, I mean, it would be awesome if it was Boba Fett, because Tatooine was the last place we saw Boba Fett, and you know, so maybe it's not just a random you know fan service choice at the end of at Tatooine.
Who was that person?
I had no guesses until that, and now the thought about Mandalorian versus Mandalorian. That sounds...
Good news, you're both wrong. That is the long-lost Darth Plagueis, who, of course, we'll be talking about so much more in Revenge of the Sith, because who better to bring someone back to life than that? One thing I will just kind of say to listeners who love, love, love The Mandalorian and each week wonder why we are ragging on it so much, I did kind of notice this was another episode written and directed by Dave Filoni, who, of course, was a huge kind of creative mind behind The Mandalorian, and as near as I can tell, he doesn't seem to have any writing or directing credits in the final three episodes. And of course, one of the directing credits is Taika Waititi, who is known to be a pretty good filmmaker. So I do wonder if there may be some new directions coming in these last three episodes. But I say that, James, I've said that each week, and as you like to say, we still have not seen certain major actors who we know are involved in the show.
The lack of Giancarlo Esposito so far has been my biggest Mando disappointment. Yeah, and I was like disappointed with that, with the because, I mean, we had that twist with Toro Calican as the character is named, the boy band guy. I was disappointed that it ended with a scene that we've seen a million times. It's like villain with a gun to the head of a hostage in a standoff, and which, correct me if I'm wrong, but that didn't even really necessarily need to happen, right? He could have just taken his prize and taken off and not just stood there waiting around to be killed by someone he knew was far better.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me a little bit of the bad guy in the long ago parody of 24 that South Park did, where he's literally dying and he says like, whatever, I could die as long as I get my money. Like, it's just kind of like, yeah, you know, the haziness with which he went from I just want to join the guild to okay, now I want to be a legend to it was sort of like motivation override, which also brings me to a larger question that I have. So the tracking fobs.
Yes.
In the first episode, I was kind of under the impression, and you guys please correct me, that the fobs were specifically something that was tracking Baby Yoda, that there was some, you know, something attached to him. I don't want to say midichlorians, but some way that they could be tracking him. Now it seems as if any bounty has a tracking fob attached to them that kind of takes you to their zone.
That seemed pretty apparent in the first episode that every bounty has a tracking fob, but it's unclear what exactly about the person that
they're
tracking.
That was my question, actually, after last week's episode when that bounty hunter showed up at the nice village looking for Baby Yoda. It's like, my question was going to be, what do these fobs do? How do they track them? Like,
it's a red flashing light. Isn't that all you need to know? And it beeps, so it makes it really easy to sneak up on people that you're trying to capture.
Well. It just seems to me as if you want to talk about a show that's really kind of cheat coding itself. And you know, I play a lot of video games. I like a lot of video games. In video games, where you're playing a bounty hunter type, and someone says like, "Go find this person. They're in this circle on the map." You know, that's kind of acceptable. But it's weird to me that, you know, in this universe, the idea of bounty hunting is basically just kind of like the person's over there. You know, there's not a lot of hunting involved in the bounty hunting part of the process.
I just assume it's some sort of space GPS that we don't understand.
I guess for me, this is a little bit like the whole Rogue One thing, where I'm just kind of like, oh, we're edging into what is the actual technology of the Star Wars universe, and it seems to involve satellites and DNA, and I'm not quite sure what that all means. James, any final thoughts on this week's episode of The Mandalorian?
I guess just one other thing is I feel like Mando is destined to be broke because he's constantly giving away these unspecified bags of metal money to anyone he comes across.
You know, guys, the Mandalorian, he's a nice guy. That's the sort of like, you know, James, I recall you saying this way back in the first episode, but it's very weird to see a show that like, again, I don't pretend to understand what The Mandalorian is doing at all, frankly, but to see a show where, like, there's kind of all the machinery there for, like, this hard-boiled loner is going to learn to be a better person, but it's kind of like, nah, he's already a pretty good person. Yeah. Like, there's not a big learning process involved, necessarily.
Unclear what his arc is at this point.
Unclear what his arc is, but he will take that helmet off at some point.
Oh, so.
No one be more about Gelcoat.
When the fourth round will...
Don't you call in the...
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here, because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th, as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
Guys, let's talk prequels here. Technically, I guess we have been, because The Mandalorian is sort of a prequel in some ways. Prequel, sequel, interquel, who knows. But in the lead up to Rise of Skywalker, which comes out in a couple of weeks, I've certainly been doing a deep dive into all Star Wars history, including the Star Wars prequels. Now, Chance.
Yes.
You and I have had some talks before about prequels in general, but Revenge of the Sith, I think that's kind of the movie that, for me, that's like the Schrodinger's cat of the prequels, where I think you kind of know where everyone stands in episode one and episode two, mm-hmm. but three is a little bit of a wild card. What was your initial experience of seeing Revenge of the Sith, and where does it kind of stand for you now?
Well, it was the first Star Wars movie I ever saw. I remember, I have a vivid memory, we were driving, I guess I was in eighth grade, we were driving back, I was doing this opera in DC, and we were driving back, and we stopped at CVS, it's like 10 p.m. at night, and like, we're like in CVS and they have the DVD, and I was like, hey, I want this. I don't know why. This looks cool. And so I got it, watched it, and then fell in love with Star Wars, and then went on, like, became like a Star Wars fanatic for that like year. And then fell off of Star Wars until the
I still
What was it like experiencing that story having not seen anything else?
It was weird, because I think because Star Wars is such a huge part of like pop culture, like you know certain stuff. Like, at that point, I knew, like, oh, the little green guy is Yoda. Apart from that, I knew nothing. And then, I was surprised about Anakin becoming Darth Vader.
God,
that
fascinating.
Even though I knew that, like, Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father, I just didn't put that together, I don't think. And then so, like, watching that, I was like, oh, this is amazing.
I always think this is so interesting because, you know, every single person I know, obviously, mm-hmm. and everyone of my generation, you know, one kind of complaint you would have about the prequels is, like, well, we just know where it's all going. There's not a whole lot of, like, you know, this is not like a Better Call Saul situation mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, there's surprises about how they got there. Like, it is kind of what you expected. But you remember watching Revenge of the Sith. Like, so there was a point around Act 1 where you were like, Anakin Skywalker seems like a pretty okay okay guy.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I was like very much into it, the movie. Like, I think, and even now when I've actually rewatched it like twice in this past week, because I keep falling asleep, but towards the end, but it's like, I think if you don't think about it, the movie just wash over you. It's like still a fun ride.
Yeah, well, and certainly like in visual terms, I think it's kind of the most distinctive from, you know, we're kind of in an era now where the palette they're pulling from is very much the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. And Revenge of the Sith, for the most part, I think is so opposite Andy of that.
Yeah.
Like it's really doing its own thing. James.
I will say, I feel like it makes them, because I remember I think it was you in your column on Phantom Menace, we're talking about how that the movie, or a lot of people come at this movie, that movie is like just a bunch of like intergalactic politics that are very, very boring. I feel like this movie sort of is half that and then half just like
it's definitely
stupid
still,
action. It's like a weird mix.
It's definitely still the kind of parliamentary stuff, which is interesting. James, what are your memories of seeing Sith for the first time? And I assume it's going to be slightly different from Chance's experience.
I mean, guys, this is where the fun begins, right? which is one of those lines that you know, the very beginning, that's one of those classic prequel lines that you're just like, you know, and you think about how actors do multiple takes of a line, and every time Hayden Christensen says that line in the beginning, I'm just like, wow, if that was the best take of that line, what was the worst take of that
line? It's so interesting, because even, I mean, he is someone who is an English first language speaker, and even the way that he says it sounds like it is being poorly translated. It's so fascinating.
My words don't sound right.
My favorite line is, wait a second, we're smarter than this, says Obi-Wan Kenobi. So, this is where the fun begins, James.
Yeah. To me, the reason Sith works well is that it's the only prequels film that really has major characters we care about in conflict with each other, which is a basic component of drama that mm-hmm. the other ones lack. I mean, Sith has this dramatic spine of the fall of Anakin Skywalker, and every time the movie is focused on that spine, it works, and we kind of lean into it. Mm-hmm. And then other times, like in the opening sequence or Obi-Wan riding a giant lizard, it works less well. So to me, it works because it's the only one that has that structure, that basic, you know, storytelling structure of characters in conflict.
Yeah. I mean, I also, going off that too, I think even rewatching it now, it reminded me most of like a season finale where like we're watching it and like no matter, like, I feel like in TV, like season finales are pretty easy in the sense that like if you've done like a basic, just like a fine job of doing your season, by the time you get to your finale, it's like that just has to be good because like you're paying off whatever you've been doing,
right.
No matter how bad or good it is. And I think here too, it's like you feel the weight of that. So it's like this movie was, it's like we feel like there's stuff happening. Whereas like Phantom Menace, or like, and I don't remember talking about that well, but like Phantom Menace is just like, I don't know what's going on. There's nothing here. And I feel like with that spine of with like Anakin's fall, it does feel like there's like momentum and weight to it a bit, I think.
I think you're right, and even I would say to me it's comparable to a season finale. I don't know, I guess like I think of something like the season 2 finale of Fringe, where you know you have a show that like in one way or another it's been kind of burying the story for a long time, or you know, certainly in the case of the prequels, you know, just not much seemed to be happening in terms of the vibrant character dynamics so much in the first two, and so now you get to the finale and it's like, oh, we're gonna kind of fit in all of that like in one big chunk. And so I think it has that kind of power to it. And even in the kind of Anakin Palpatine, you know, I don't think Hayden Christensen is bringing too much to the table, but Ian McDiarmid is bringing a lot to their kind of dynamic. And I find that to be really kind of interesting.
It's also,
I texted you during my rewatch that this has my favorite scene in the prequels. And turns out J.J. Abrams' favorite scene as well, as he noted in a recent interview. And that's, as you referred to earlier, you know, the space opera scene. Between Palpatine and Anakin, you know, to me this is like the one prequel scene where everything works. It's actually written well, it's directed well, it's acted well, it's suspenseful and moody and intriguing, and Ian McDiarmid is just chewing up that monologue, and you know it's just a terrific scene.
And that scene is so interesting too, because it is, a long dialogue scene that, you know, on one hand, I think it works so much because of his performance. It doesn't surprise me that J.J. Abrams likes that scene, because there is this sense that, for really, I think, the only time in George Lucas's filmography, dialogue is kind of telling you something without necessarily saying what it's telling you, in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, the myth of Dark Plagueis and the idea of creating life and saving it, and this is not anything new, there is this sort of long-running fan theory that that's basically Darth Sidious, the Emperor, telling Anakin Skywalker, who happens to be born of a virgin, as we discovered in Phantom Menace, like, I created you. And I mean, you know, I did some digging, and there is some canonical stuff that seems to support that. It's not totally clear if that was the intention, but I just find that in general, the power of that scene is something pretty distinct, even from stuff in much, much better Star Wars movies. Like, there's nothing like that scene in Empire, and certainly nothing like that scene in the recent movies. Chance, you said you were rewatching Revenge of the Sith mm-hmm. a couple times this week. You were falling asleep a yes. little bit. How does Chance today think of Sith compared to Chance, who's discovering Star Wars for the first time?
It's funny. I like that opera scene, but at the same time, I don't know, I feel like the movie is like, there's no, and I guess maybe this is what we shouldn't expect it from these movies, but there's like no like subtlety in the way, and like the fall of Anakin. It's very much just like, no, it's like every scene is like dedicated to that. There's no dancing around. It's just like, this is thinly veiled. Oh, he's going down the dark path, you know? And
because even when he's still kind of nominally, you know, in an okay frame of mind, there's an early scene where, you know, he's talking to Padme, who of course is his wife, the mother of his mm-hmm. child. And she kind of says sort of, you know, just kind of some fun chat between husband and wife, like, maybe our government should be a little more diplomatic. And he tells her, like, you sound like a separatist, which is really, I mean, I don't know. That to me, that's the kind of extremity you're talking about. Where there's no sort of casual dialogue between those two ever, which is, you know, I think that's a failing as far as kind of etching in those characters a little bit mm-hmm. more. But it does give it this, you know, really unique feel. For me, the other scene that kind of sticks out, and, you know, as cheesy as George Lucas's instincts could be, every now and then it could really deliver. But when he's kind of making his decision to rescue Palpatine, there's the shot of like he's on the rooftop of like, I think, the Jedi Temple, and Padme is over in their penthouse, and the sun is setting over Coruscant, mm-hmm. and there's just something about, you know, the excess of that. I do think that, you know, in terms of sheer effects terms, this is kind of the one movie where the digital effects don't look embarrassing the way they kind of do in the first two. I will just shout it really quickly. Just thinking about what do you want out of a Star Wars movie? Having a good secondary villain goes a long way, and General Grievous, I think, is an all-timer for me. Like, that's a really interesting and weird and kind of inexplicable member of the dark side to be sort of like facing, you know, during the hour of the movie that comes before the big Jedi purge.
Well, yeah, I mean, James pointed this out, how this movie, like, the character dynamics, it's sort of weird. And when I was rewatching it, it did strike me as odd, like, how much of this movie, though, is devoted to, like, Obi-Wan, and James just brought this up, but, like, Obi-Wan off on his own with General Grievous, which, like, I don't know, it just, like, for me, I'm like, this is a two-hour movie, and, like,
That feels like padding to you.
Yeah, I don't know, or just, like,
I think that's fair.
It's weird, I don't know, I just, it didn't.
It's weird that is so clearly distinct from the back half of the movie, which is really when, you know, like, I think actually Grievous dies right before Order 66 goes out and the Jedi all die. I think, like, it's almost kind of like this is the end of the regular Star Wars adventure and the beginning of the great purge of the younglings.
To me, General Grievous did nothing for me. He was another sort of these prequel CGI paper tiger villains that that come up and then get easily dispatched.
Right. He's like another Count Dooku.
But you're talking about that sun setting scene. I think that might be one of the only maybe time that George Lucas put the camera on an actor without dialogue and just lets them act.
Yeah.
In the entire prequels. And then it goes into my second favorite sequence in the prequels, and that is, you know, the scene with Mace Windu and the Emperor, arguably, I think that's actually the most disturbing death scene in all the Star Wars films. Yeah. I was rewatching it. 1,000%. I was like, I forgot how awful this is. This is really kind of, you know, it's hard to imagine Disney now having that scene exactly as it played in because, you know, I mean, it's Samuel L. Jackson, and he's being betrayed and maimed and tortured and then thrown out a window.
It is I think especially I think we've talked about his performance a lot, but Ian McDiarmid's performance in that moment, the way that he says no, is just so creepy.
He's so
and
good.
I think that's one thing that sticks out of my mind whenever I think back to watching it for the first time or for the first few times when I got the DVD, was like that specific moment.
Yeah, and you know, to me, I guess that you know, as much as I do struggle with a lot of this movie, and I certainly think that you guys are right to say there's a lot of padding. We don't even need to talk about Yoda hanging out with the Wookiees at all. There's something so interestingly dissonant that this movie can get away with when, you know, we're in this sort of universe that really, by this point in the prequels, it's pretty bland, and like, you know, even like, you know, poor Natalie Portman, she spends the whole movie in these just sort of like, you know, becurtained rooftopscapes that just all look so kind of like, it simultaneously like seems expensive, but also looks so bland and boring.
She only leaves the apartment at the end of the movie, right?
Exactly, immediately die of a broken heart, and you know, there's a lot to struggle with on that front, certainly. But to have a movie like this, which again, you know, the blandness of it all, then a scene like that where you literally have Palpatine, he's like crisping himself, mm-hmm. and the way that he screams, I really want to say, what a performance! He almost sounds kind of like he's getting off on it a little bit. It's such a weird like burst of pure Clive Barker Hellraiser energy.
Right.
I think that kind of sets the table for what you're describing, James, that, you know, Mace Windu, who, I mean, more than anything, I think, you know, Jackson in these movies had just been this sort of like strong, silent, floating, you know, not really a lot to Mace Windu, unfortunately, in the earlier movies, but to just dispatch him in this way, there's something really haunting about it. That for me, that cuts deeper than even anything in the newer Disney movies, which have had, you know, bigger character deaths and have had these sort of like, you know, more obviously violent moments. There's something about that back and forth that I find really kind of interesting. James, so do you say, does the movie kind of rank higher for you now, or does it work more for you now than it did when you first saw it?
I mean, it was always my favorite of the prequels. I just feel like I got a little bit more clarity on what I like about it this time around, and also Attack of the Clones upon this rewatch also just sank even further. There's literally a scene, there's literally like two scenes in Attack of the Clones of Anakin Skywalker carrying luggage. It is just, I mean, one day we're going to do Attack of the Clones and we're going to have a blast. But I just want to throw out another bit of Palpatine. My favorite line is in the opera box when he goes, "Leave us," to the other people in the opera box, and for that one, those two words, he slips into his cold, biting Emperor voice,
and then goes
back to his honey-tongued politician voice,
man,
and it's such a neat little choice in that moment. And I think that performance really is. I think, you know, really the reason that he's in Rise of Skywalker is probably less of a story or a plot reason than J.J. Abrams just being really impressed with that performance, and as he told us in an interview, you know, being very kind of haunted and scared of the Emperor when he first watched Return of the Jedi as a kid. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that occurred to me about Revenge of the Sith is the story I kept thinking of, and this isn't, you know, to put down Revenge of the Sith at all, but the story I kept thinking of, and I texted this to you when watching it, I think, was Pet Sematary. because it's a man trying to save his family by cheating death, and he makes a series of worsening decisions resulting in doom for them all.
Yeah.
And it kind of has that same sense of inevitability and dread to it.
Totally, yeah. The inevitability of it, the fact that he's not only killing his family, but, you know, destroying the entirety of his civilization. And I will just say that, you know, for as much as I think a lot of Lucas's instincts as a filmmaker by now were like almost kind of like destructive for how we think about cinema, there's something about the lava planet and the fact that, like, you know, that was kind of a vision that I think, you know, I believe Ralph McQuarrie had sort of, you know, initially kind of conceived of that, and he kind of conceived of it years and years ago, and the final kind of return to that, and the way that, I mean, the planet itself almost seems to be sort of tearing itself apart as Anakin and Obi-Wan are having their battle. And, you know, I think that's partially just, for me, you know, the scene that I kept thinking of actually was from House of Flying Daggers, when the two main characters are fighting, and, you know, they're fighting over a lot of things that are hard to explain, and, you know, they both love the same woman, yada, yada. But, like, all around them, it sort of goes from summer to winter, just kind of like by sheer force of their antagonism. There's something, I don't know, again, Lucas was in a lot of ways a kind of prosaic filmmaker, but there's something about just the excess of that that really kind of works for me. So I don't know, this is kind of the one that I will keep returning to. I think I like it more even than maybe Return of the Jedi now, just because for me, Return of the Jedi obviously has like the awesome, for, you know, the awesomeness of the Jabba the Hutt stuff, and then it kind of dwindles away. And like Revenge of the Sith, which has a lot of flab in the middle, boy, that killer final lava sequence is really something to work towards. Am I crazy here, James? You can tell me if I'm crazy.
I don't know. I haven't put those two up in my head versus each other. I have kind of some mixed thoughts about Return of the Jedi too, so I'd have to kind of process that a little bit. I do like what you're saying about the lava planet. It's hard to get more dramatic, right, than a lava planet. And so I was always really looking forward to seeing that fight. I think clearly Ewan McGregor and Hayden Christensen just, you know, gave that fight everything they got. I mean, their choreography was terrific. Their whole clash was really well done. You know, at the same time, there are bits and pieces in there that bug me from like the floating on the bad CGI lava droids to some of the dialogue that George couldn't help putting in there, like, from my point of view, it's the Jedi who are evil, just in case you're unclear of my point of view as a character. And don't try it, Anakin. As you can clearly see, I have the higher ground. It's like, why even, no? Don't, even, you know, where's Erwin Kershner to like cross those out floating, of the script to
even
like.
Even the floating CGI though is kind of interesting, because Chance, I want to know, what did like eighth grade Chance think about the scene where the main character of the movie kind of jumps off the screen, and then Obi-Wan just kind of like runs his lightsaber up, and suddenly Anakin has no limbs left. Like, that is like truly one of the most disturbing, and again, the fact that it's so bloodless makes it kind of more disturbing in a way, because he's just sort of suddenly down there being consumed by lava.
Like, I mean, at that point, I thought that was like the coolest thing ever. Like, I'm pretty sure the thing I liked about Star Wars when I first watched was like lightsabers. I don't know. As a kid, I was always into swords, and I think that was what I loved the most.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
like,
of course,
like the best use of a lightsaber. It's
like, he just like Obi-Wan, and again, it's kind of off screen. Obi-Wan just sort of like raises up his lightsaber, and suddenly it's like there. I guess he has his cyborg hand still, but there is a one limbed like torso that's just falling down the side
just
of the
mountain. Just writhing and then getting burned.
Oh,
it's like
my
so
God!
Gnarly.
It's horrible.
So gnarly.
I do love that realizing he's becoming Darth Vader was like a twist for you, because that must have been, you know, for a lot of people watching the prequels, that must have been like, you know, yeah, it's interesting how that can play as a twist for some viewers and kind of, you know, inevitability for others.
Yeah,
I mean, when I was rewatching it last night, I like wrote down, I think this movie works a lot better if you don't know anything about the Star Wars universe. Right. It's like going back to Palpatine's death, like, or not death, his like scarring, when he gets scarred. It's like, one way to read that is, oh, they're explaining why he looks like a disheveled zombie, right, like a shriveled up zombie in the original trilogy. But knowing nothing, it's like, oh, this is actually
right.
It's freaky and just gross and kind of awesome.
Which I will say, though, that scene does kind of bring up something, and this is, I think, in some ways, the easiest complaint to have about the movie. Like, the explaining of things that don't need explaining, which has become so central to a lot of Star Wars prequel lore, which always, like, brings me back to, though, the kind of throwaway moment right at the end, when Yoda's just like, by the way, Obi-Wan, do some more training, because it turns out that people can return from the netherworld of the Force. And it's just an interesting moment because, like, you know, at least I had never really thought that much about the Force ghosts in the pre, you know, it just seemed like, well, that's, you know, if you're a Jedi, you can kind of appear and you're a ghost and that's fine, but it's not like you're doing anything to do that. It's just kind of part of the mysticism. So, but the idea that actually the Jedi had to develop that skill set, and again, the idea that there is a netherworld of the Force, it's a lot to take in kind of all at once, and I don't think it necessarily works to the movie's credit. The other obvious, the obvious thing here is, like, we finally see Alderaan and it looks really nice, and you're like, oh, but that planet is going to get blown up in like 20 years. Which, again, I think that's the weird power of this movie is, like, I'm not sure George Lucas really thought he was making a deeply disturbing movie, but, like, the main character of the movie kills lots of kids at one point. He and his colleagues kill a character played by George Lucas's son. Like, it's just so fascinating in a way. I think that's why this one kind of like lives and breathes for me in a way that some of the others don't necessarily. James, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the fact that we are going to see a Palpatine in some respect in Skywalker has been a big sort of mystery going into this movie. And I have to say, like, I was skeptical about it just because it does seem like, you know, the last Star Wars movie killed the fake emperor, so now let's bring back the real one. But I'm excited just because I do love the actor so much and the performance so much. So just echoing what you were saying earlier, like, I am kind of really intrigued to see in what capacity he is back now. Is that kind of your feeling now too, that like whatever gets us more Ian McDiarmid is probably a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's like sort of the more of a physical form he takes, the less believable it is, yet that's what I want. It's like if he's like back and just looks like a guy again, I'm like, fine, you know, just say whatever space logic you want to say, and I'll I'm good with it.
I'm curious. I mean, again, so I've been like with the Star Wars movies, I've been trying to not read anything and just go into them knowing nothing.
That's the right call.
Which I don't do for anything. I'm sure why, because I really don't care about Star Wars at all, but I feel like, anyway, but I'm still curious about, like, because we know that he's back, but, like, to what extent, and so, like, I'm curious if this is going to end up being, like, a 1-2 scene thing, right, you know? Or, like, is it actually going to be that big of a deal?
It's sort of unclear to me, and I will say, I was just rewatching The Force Awakens and remembering that the shot in Force Awakens where you see Luke's robo-hand on R2-D2 was, like, one of the most talked about things in The Force Awakens trailer, and that's basically the only time you see, until the very end, that's the only time you see either of those characters in the movie. So, yeah, I wonder about that myself, Chance. But it's going to be interesting to see to what extent he's in it. I'm down for anything. I'm down if it turns out that there was actually a good Palpatine, like, twin. Like, you know, he's just like, oh yeah, like, I've been hanging out on Naboo, where I'm from, by the way. Don't anybody ever forget that I came from Naboo, where all bad things come from.
Frank Palpatine.
Yeah, thanks Palpatine. That wraps it up for this week's episode of Star Wars Untold Stories. Come back next week when we'll be talking to our pal Devin Kogan all about Star Wars The Last Jedi, a not controversial movie at all. Thanks as always to my good pal James Hibbard, my other good pal Chancellor Agard, who will hopefully be rejoining us in a couple of weeks to talk about Rise of Skywalker when it's out in theaters. I'm Darren Franich. If you enjoy what you've listened to, you can tweet at us. He's at James Hibbard. I'm at Darren Franich. Chance, on Twitter, you are?
At Chancellor Agard.
At Chancellor Agard. If you like what you hear, Give us a rate, give us a review. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio.com, wherever you get your podcasts. We love hearing from you. A lot to talk about to do with Star Wars this month. And until next week, I have spoken.